Hello, and welcome to a special edition of KBOO's Labor Radio of the Working Class, by the Working Class, for the Working Class.
Following is a six-part series reading the introduction in Chapter 1, Chapter 2, Chapter 3, Chapter 4, Chapter 5, and Chapter 6 with the appendices. So, six parts. This is the first.
Reading Democracy is Power, Rebuilding Unions from the Bottom Up by Mike Parker and Martha Gruley, a Labor Notes book available for $10 at labornotes.org. This first edition will include the introduction and first.
Each chapter takes about an hour to read. The DSA Labor Working Group is sponsoring a discussion, a book discussion, three Sundays in July, beginning on July 11th, then July 18th, and then July 25th. First Sunday will be a discussion of the introduction, chapters 1 and 2, the second Sunday, chapters 3 and 4, and the third Sunday, chapters 4 and 5. Please join for all three Sundays.
6 to 7:30 p.m. Register for that discussion at bit.ly/3SundaysDemocracy. That's lowercase bit.ly/3SundaysDemocracy, DEMOCRACY. Now, for the introduction and first and second chapters, about power. This book is about democracy and power for working people. It assumes that working people need more power and that the first way we get it is through our unions. Strong unions are good for their members, for all working people, and for building a more democratic society. The book is built on six themes. Union power requires democracy. Unions need active members to be strong, and people won't stay involved for long if they don't have control of the union's program. Two, the workplace, is not the union hall, is the starting place for the union democracy, because the purpose of democratic control in the union is to make it more effective against the boss. If members choose and organize their own job actions, they'll bring that power into union meetings. Three, no set of rules can guarantee democracy. When we talk about democracy, we mean much more than fair election procedures, for instance, although rules are important tools. We mean a culture of control by the members. Four, racism and sexism are still barriers to union democracy. We can't just remove explicit discrimination and be done. Democratic unions consciously and actively strive to include everyone. Five, working people are fit to run our own affairs. We are intelligent, can act cooperatively, and are fully capable of analyzing our situation and crafting the best strategy to improve it. Given real choices, we will overcome our prejudices and work for the betterment of all. Six, members have the right to organize around a view of how to run the union. This means more than the right to voice opinions. We have the right to work with others who agree to convince still more to come along. This is the essence of building a reform movement in the union. From the perspective of the reformer in a corrupt union, it seems that the main barriers to rank and file control are union officials who use undemocratic rules, goon squads, and deals with management to ward off any threat to their perks. Unfortunately, there's no shortage of examples. But increasingly, as reformers of various degrees and stripes take power in locals and gain more influence in international unions, it's clear that there are other enemies. Sometimes members make tremendous sacrifices to reform their union, only to find that the new leaders they have elected turn out to be almost as dictatorial as the ones they replaced. These new officers may genuinely have the members' interests at heart, but believe the ranks are best served if the leaders maintain control. And reform-minded leaders often find that it's not so easy to involve members in running the union. They complain that members refuse to participate and prefer to let the servicing rep take care of business. Sometimes it even seems, paradoxically, that members prefer those who would deny them power in the union if they think it will get them more power on the job. Thus, we often see corrupt and bureaucratic officials gaining a following and get elected because they talk tough against the employer. The truth is that the enemies of democracy are not just a bunch of corrupt officials. Democracy is undermined systematically by many forces in our society. These include the power of employers to interfere in unions, the belief that democracy is simply about correct procedures, and the hope that someone else will do all the hard work. The impetus for this book comes from three sources. First, reformers in a number of unions who have won local and some national leadership positions want to restructure their unions to make them genuinely democratic. Contact information for some of these groups appears in Appendix 6. Second, serious rank-and-file reformers want to carefully pinpoint what is wrong with their unions so that their call for change is not just a complaint, but a plan for the better way, for a better way. Third, the election of the current AFL-CIO leadership in 1995, this book was written in 1999, led to an emphasis on organizing and member involvement. But as advocates of the, quote, organizing model, unquote, are discovering, seeking to involve members inevitably raises the question of democracy within the union. Indeed, parts of this book will sound familiar to someone with good training in organizing. Quote, organizing, unquote, in its best sense, helping people work together to achieve what they want, is another way to say, quote, union democracy, unquote, where organizing people, whether it's those who already have a union or those who want a new one, does not put them in charge of their own activity, it's not democratic, nor is it powerful. We have three aims. To make the case that democracy is essential to the power of the union. Democracy is not simply a moral question, but the key to unions' ability to meet today's challenges from management and government alike. Two, to lay out guidelines activists can use to create and maintain a democratic union environment. And three, to use these guidelines to sort through some tough questions about democratic procedure. How do we get members involved? How do we conduct elections? How do we handle dissent? The answers are not obvious. What seems democratic to a dissident in a local union, such as filling all positions by election rather than appointment, may not look so appealing or democratic to the reformer who has just won a close election and wants to sweep out the corruption. There are no universal right answers on most of these questions. At the same time, similarities among modern unions and the problems they face make some answers pretty common. Instead of providing a manual of procedures with yes-no positions, we try to provide some analytic tools so that unionists can choose what is most appropriate for their situation. Two subjects are not goals of this book, although they certainly fall within the heading of union democracy. It is not our aim to compile a list of atrocities against democracy. Where we can learn something from discussing a bad union practice, we do so. Many egregious examples are left out. This is also not a book about the legal rights of union members. Assuring legal rights is an important tool for democracy, but it is far from the whole solution. An excellent resource on legal rights is the Association for Union Democracy. The material for this book comes from many sources. Many unions have long histories of struggling with the question of internal democracy. We draw most heavily on recent experiences within the Teamsters. In the last decade, that the struggle in that union has taught us the most lessons about winning rank-and-file democracy, although clearly the Teamsters still have a long way to go. One of our most important sources is the experience of the Reform Caucus Teamsters for a Democratic Union, formed in 1976 out of a struggle against a poor contract in the freight industry. The organization grew from a tiny group of rank-and-filers to a large and influential movement. Much of its success is owed to TDU's own form of membership control. Because we refer to TDU and the Teamsters so frequently within this book, we have included a history and description of TDU below. Many of our ideas come directly from other organized reform groups, particularly New Directions in the UAW, United Auto Workers, another New Directions in the Transport Workers Local 100, and REAP in the United Food and Commercial Workers. Our monthly publication, Labor Notes, has covered reform movements in a number of U.S. and Canadian unions and a few in other countries such as Mexico, Brazil, and Germany. Others have written thoughtfully on union democracy. In particular, we have learned from the work of Herman Benson, Steve Early, and Michael Eisenshire. Our first three chapters lay out ideas basic to understanding the potential power of union democracy and the roadblocks to fulfilling this potential. Later chapters look at how to put these ideas into practice. The appendices focus mostly on holding good meetings, a necessary but not sufficient aspect of union democracy. Appendix 5 suggests some pointers on bylaws. The reader will notice that we've written the book for two different audiences, and that therefore the assumptions about what's going on in the local union vary from section to section. The two audiences are rank-and-file reformers working to democratize their unions in the face of opposition from incumbent officials, and reformers who are in office. Thus, we've emphasized two kinds of action: ways for members to organize to stop poor practices, hold leaders accountable, and force their views on a reluctant officialdom, and ways for officials to get the members involved in building strong unions. Like any Labor Notes book, we consider this one a work in progress. The authors, the Labor Notes staff and policy committee, and other leaders in our network fully expect to learn more about union democracy as unionists comment on this book and as they forge ahead in the nitty-gritty of building democracy. New ideas and new stories can be expected in the pages of Labor Notes. Please send us yours. What is Teamsters for a Democratic Union? TDU is a movement of Teamsters dedicated to reforming their union. Teamster spouses and retirees and members in both the United States and Canada are welcome as members. TDU is funded by its members' dues of $35 per year, about the same as a month's union dues for most, and by their donations. TDU has a sister organization, the Teamster Rank and File Education and Legal Defense Fund, that carries on education and legal work only. TRF receives foundation grants and non-Teamster donations. TDU got its start in the 1970s among Teamsters pushing for a stronger national freight contract. Their immediate goal was to show that the union could get better agreements if members voted down bad contracts and were willing to strike. Since top officials were trying to sell the contracts, TDUers saw officials' lack of accountability as a major impediment to taking on the employers. Starting from a few dozen truck drivers and dock workers spreading information about bargaining demands, TDU grew to include several thousand members in the mid-90s from every Teamster jurisdiction. From its founding in 1976 until 1989, TDU's main emphasis was on contracts, pushing bargainers and between negotiations working on grievances. But by the mid-80s, TDU was still small, but had enough influence to convince a majority to vote no on concessionary contracts in the freight industry, at UPS, and for car haulers. That's the truck drivers who move new cars from the factory or seaport to the dealer's lot. At the same time, TDUers listened to members talk about how their officials were selling them out. TDU agitated for the right to vote directly for top officials to help keep them accountable. The Teamsters, like most U.S. unions, elected top officers at conventions. Unlike most, the Teamsters conventions were almost entirely composed of ex officio delegates, local officials who automatically became delegates by virtue of their office, with no chance for rank and filers to vote for delegates. The effect was a closed system of local and international officers helping each other maintain power without having to consult the ranks. In 1989, the system was knocked open. The Justice Department pressured old guard officials to allow a rank-and-file vote for top officers, with candidates nominated at a convention where all delegates had to be elected for that purpose. TDU backed a local president, not of their ranks, Ron Curry, who had been outspoken nationally on UPS contracts. With TDU's network of trained activists, Curry won the election in 1991. The Teamsters Union began to change, although the many old guard officials still firmly embedded at regional and local levels resisted fiercely. TDU worked with the Curry administration, supporting it against the old guard while pushing it farther on reforms. TDUers continued all kinds of organizing within the union, including running for local office. The fight for democracy was far from finished. In 1997, an election scandal threatened reform efforts. Ron Curry, in his successful 1996 re-election campaign, had hired consultants who carried out an illegal contribution swap scheme. The government barred Curry from the rerun election, but TDUers understood what Curry himself had said: it's not about one man. Though angered at the government's removal of Curry, TDUers pushed on. They organized to back a new slate of candidates led by Tom Leadham. Leadham was a local president and head of the union's 400,000-member warehouse division. By the way, Tom Leadham is from Portland and from Local 206. Leadham, as a local president and head of the union's 400,000-member warehouse division, was a solid practitioner of rank-and-file power through democracy. The Leadham slate did remarkably well in December 1998. After campaigning only 6 months, compared to Hoffa's four-year effort, outspent 7-1, they garnered about 39% of the vote. The reform slate won a majority among members of those locals that included a sizable number of people covered by national contracts. This was the group that most affected by the policies of the international and the group most knowledgeable about international union affairs. As in 1991 and 1996, the best reform vote came from the areas and the locals where TDU was the strongest. TDU acts locally. Because TDU dealt with national contract issues for freight workers, UPSers, and many other Teamsters, it took on a national structure from the beginning. For instance, TDU held national conventions while the organization was still small and distributed centrally produced national TDU contract bulletins. But most of the TDU's activity was and is carried out at the local level. Local activists distribute TDU information and bulletins and do much more. They are essential organizers, talking up the issues among members, hearing what they think, and communicating responses and concerns back to the national office. Based on this local organizing, they discuss strategy for the next steps. Local activists work to build a TDU chapter in their area. In some cities, the chapter will include members from several different Teamster locals. In some places, there's only one Teamster local or only one with an active TDU membership. Chapter members can determine their own structure, finances, and priorities. If the chapter is new or not very strong, its members may do little more than pass out TDU's newspaper, Convoy Dispatch, to co-workers and sponsor an occasional meeting with a guest speaker from TDU headquarters. A more active chapter will have a leadership body, meetings, campaigns around local and national issues, and methods of raising money. Naturally, each chapter's strength and activity will vary over time depending on many factors, a major one being the energy and effectiveness of its volunteer leaders. Within each chapter, certain local unions may take center stage at different times. TDU's national leadership and staff and the national newspaper provide these groups a picture of how they fit into the overall scene. Are there bylaws proposals similar to reforms that have worked in other locals? Are there co-workers upset about the same workplace problems as Teamsters across the country? What responses are being tried elsewhere? Like reformers in other unions, TDU activists in some locals must do double duty. They take over much of the work abandoned by lazy and corrupt officials: member education, organizing around grievances, determining priorities for bargaining, while at the same time pushing officials to change their ways or be moved aside. Here's how those activities might fit together. Maybe someone notices that a TDU member has a lot of contract information and asks about a particular problem. The TDU member helps his coworker get more information from the national office, if needed, and helps file a grievance, which the local officials sit on. Meanwhile, TDU members are asking around to see if the problem is widespread and finding out that many people are concerned about it. They plan carry out a show of solidarity, like taking turns dropping by the supervisor's office to quote the contract. After about a day of this, the business agent magically appears and the grievance is won. Then perhaps one of the chapter members writes a story about the win for the convoy, and the chapter orders extra copies of that issue. Many of the people who helped pressure the boss sign up for TDU. One of them has friends in a different company where conditions have really deteriorated since the last contract, and they start asking questions too. Eventually, the group decides to run one of its members for steward. When they run to take over the local, TDUers often form coalition slates with independent forces. When they win, they can look to the national TDU office for help in setting up their new administration. As more TDUers have won office, the organization has held special meetings for reform officers. You will find much more information about TDU in the chapters that follow. To contact TDU, see Appendix 6. Chapter 1. Democracy is Power. If our real goal is strong unions, powerful ones, why bother with democracy? Because we have to. Let's look at power and democracy. We learned in civics class where the original word, democracy, came from. In Greek, it's demos, the people, kraten, to rule. Kraten, to rule. The people rule. All the procedures and protections that we usually associate with democracy, elections, rights to debate, a free press, for example, are simply means to achieve the power of the people. The procedures, the means, are often confused with democracy itself, the goal, for two reasons. First, the procedures are usually necessary to reach the goal of democracy. The more complicated our society, the more we need division of labor, representatives, leaders, experts, and rules for how to make decisions. Second, it's in the interest of those who don't want the people to rule, that we get distracted from the goal and hung up on the procedures instead. We will talk more about this later. Where do unions fit in? To begin with, unions exist to give workers power in society where the bulk of the economic and political power is held by those who control the corporations. When unions make working people more powerful, they are imposing some democracy on a society which otherwise is not very democratic at all. The basic reason working people organize unions is for power over pay and conditions in the workplace. That is, the most important place where members measure the union strength and also where we measure union democracy. No matter what happens at meetings or conventions, the union will not be democratic unless members control its actions on workplace issues. That's why union reform efforts are strongest when their message is, we need to fix the union so it can win changes the members need at work. If members think a bylaw change will make it easier to win grievances, they'll have a good reason to come to a meeting to vote on it. If an opposition slate has a better idea on how to deal with forced overtime, it may seem worth the effort to campaign for that slate. Union democracy is about power in the workplace. Most union members would agree that the United States could use a healthy dose of democracy, especially in the workplace. But that does not automatically mean that democracy is the best method for running a union. If there were a non-democratic way to run unions that gave workers more power in society and against the boss, then members would have to consider it. In fact, there are many people, members as well as leaders, who believe that democracy actually weakens the union. They say it's a luxury that only gets in the way of unity and swift action. Few leaders will say this in front of the members, of course. In the Teamsters, for example, officials who had tried for years to keep members from having the right to vote for their president gave convention speeches in favor of it when the election was imminent. But behind closed doors, you would hear some union staffers or officers assert, members aren't interested in democracy, they're interested in results. We'll get good results if we, the leaders, just come up with the right plan. There's a little box here. Democracy and corporations go together like pacifism and ice hockey. Unions promote democracy in two ways. First, to the extent that unions, even bureaucratic ones, offer a counterforce to the power of corporations, they play a crucial role in democratizing society. Second, unions themselves are held to democratic standards, if imperfectly so, by their own principles, by the expectations of society, and by law. Members have avenues for reforming their unions. Compare the expectation of democratic rights, even in a highly bureaucratic union, to your rights on the job. The corporation makes not even a pretense of democracy or protection of anyone's rights except the owners and managers. In a non-union workplace, you can devote most of your productive years to serving a corporation and then be fired for speaking your mind, or for not appearing enthusiastic, or for any reason at all except the few specifically prohibited by law. If the standard to which we hold unions is democratic rights, the standard the society holds for corporations is bottom-of-the-line profit. By their nature, all unions contribute far more to the level of democracy in the world than any corporation. And here's another box. Even a little democracy counts. In 1987 and 1990, UPS contracts were bargained under similar conditions. The same old guard union leadership, the same financially healthy company. Both contracts were negotiated without strikes and without union-sponsored contract campaigns. But the 1990 settlement was substantially better for UPS Teamsters. The difference was the amount of member control. In 1989, the government forced the union to schedule a membership vote on international officers who control national bargaining with UPS. The election campaign was well underway in 1990 when old guard officials announced they'd bargain a better pay package at UPS than the one they had bargained a better pay package at UPS than the one they had gladly accepted in 1987. As Ken Paff, national organizer of TDU, put it, the officials couldn't say any more to the members, we don't care. They had to care. Officials had to care because there was a widespread dissatisfaction with the 1987 settlement, and this time around, even a little discontent would cost bargainers their jobs. That little bit of democracy was worth an extra $1.23 an hour for UPS Teamsters. Okay, back to the main text. We're talking about union officials here. They may simply leave democracy out. A clear example of the militancy without democracy point of view appeared in a spring 1996 article by Stephen Lerner, published by the Boston Review. Lerner was architect of SEIU's, that's Service Employees International Union, Justice for Janitors campaign under John Sweeney, and then became an AFL-CIO staff member. Lerner rightly notes that unions can only inspire workers if we abandon, quote, partnership, unquote, with corporations. Instead, we need to show that we can take on and beat aggressive employers. He proposes an action program, for the labor movement, calling for mobilizing the most active 1% of union members into, quote, an army ready to risk arrest to bring whole cities to a standstill, unquote. Certainly, such action is needed. But one plank is missing. Lerner said not a word about rank-and-file initiative or control of these militant actions. Quite the contrary. Lerner clearly means officials and staff when he says we should build campaigns that give our members reason to be involved. Workers are to be activated, in Lerner's word, to cannon fodder version of organizing. In this view, member control is not relevant to building unions. But far from being a distraction, internal democracy is key to union power. First, a union will act in the interests of members only if those members control the union. If members do not control their union, then others tend to run it in their own interest. Management, the mob, or officials seeking to preserve their easy job and comfortable lifestyle, if not line their own pockets, the opportunities are just too rich to be passed up. Even a leader with a personal commitment to the members' interests, but who lacks serious input from them, is vulnerable to the other interests just mentioned. Second, the power of the union lies in the participation of its members, and it requires democracy to make members want to be involved. A union that tries to function without member involvement becomes weak no matter how well intentioned its officers. Officers seeking participation without asking what the members want to accomplish will be frustrated. A union run by the members is also more likely to exercise its power. When the members run the union, they have chances to measure their collective strength against the boss and gain confidence to use it. When members, for instance, see that a cartoon they posted on the union bulletin board really shakes up the supervisor, they start thinking about other ways to push that boss's discomfort into positive changes, and they think up more cartoon ideas. Yet many unions keep their bulletin boards behind locked glass. When members are in the habit of using their heads to figure out the problems of running the union, handling disagreements among themselves, setting priorities for scarce resources, learning each other's concerns, they have more effective ideas for dealing with management's assaults as well. Conversely, if the rank and file can't even control their own union, how are they going to control some aspects of a big corporation? And who would dare to try? Does democracy make the union more powerful in every instance? Democratic rule allows, even guarantees, that members will make mistakes, even serious ones. For example, leaders may worry that members will believe management's fear campaign and want to give concessions that will undercut another local. Such concerns are real, but not valid arguments against democracy. First, there's no evidence that any system other than democracy is less prone to mistakes. Indeed, we have ample evidence that the self-proclaimed experts are fooled at least as often as the members. One example, throughout the 1980s and 1990s, experts and leaders signed on to a string of labor management cooperation fads. In the Postal Service, it was called employee involvement. When members are cynical about the flavor of the month, new program, and reluctant to give up union rights, leaders chalked it up to thinking inside the box and fear of change. As it turned out, the members were right and the experts were wrong. Any reader from an undemocratic union will have his or her own examples of strategic mistakes by officials that most members could have avoided. Second, members have the right to make their own mistakes. They deserve to decide for themselves how best to improve their lives and their children's lives. Third, as members learn from and correct their mistakes as a group, they're better able to avoid repeating them. An individual dictator seldom has a clear view of his own failed policies, and he has a stake in not admitting them. Democracy, with its mistakes and inefficiencies, works better than any other arrangement. See the boxes below on machinists at Boeing and Teamsters at UPS for examples. Okay, let's just look at the machinist box. Machinist right to review leads to victory. At the Boeing Company, a fight for democratic reform in union practices led to victory over management. In 1995, officials of the machinists' local lodges, that is, local unions, at Boeing agreed to a demand put forward by reform caucuses in Seattle and Wichita. As contract negotiations approached, officials announced that for the first time, members would have 3 days to review the tentative contract before voting on it. The reform caucuses had demanded this window because of their experience 3 years earlier. Seattle members had voted on a deal only moments after it was presented to them at a mass meeting. Later, they discovered that the agreement they had voted on was incomplete. The officials continued to negotiate in secret over several unresolved issues. When the contract was finally distributed 4 months after the ratification meeting, it contained language that the members had never voted on. In 1995, the ranks used a three-day period to demonstrate their unity and opposition to the contract with marches and rallies, some led by rank-and-file activists, some by union officials who could see which way the wind was blowing, and others erupted spontaneously. One group marched through the huge Everett, Washington complex, banging their toolboxes as they went. A group in Wichita occupied the plant for 2 days. 30,000 members overwhelmingly rejected an agreement that would have loosened protections on contracting out and required workers to pay a portion of health insurance premiums. Instead, workers embarked on a militant strike. After 6 weeks on the picket line, they voted by 61% to reject yet another offer, this one endorsed unanimously by union officers at all levels. Finally, after 10 weeks on the picket line, workers returned to their plants with an agreement that maintained tighter restrictions on subcontracting, added no copays on insurance, and included substantial wage increases and a signing bonus. In rejecting their leaders' recommendations, machinists handed the labor movement its best victory of the 1990s to that point. But the victory might never have happened if the membership had not had the opportunity to review the contract. The 3 days proved to be a crucial period for members to show the company, union officials, and themselves that they were prepared to strike. A pre-vote review period had been a demand of reformers since the mid-1980s, but caucus organizing began in earnest in both cities in the early 1990s. In 1992, the Seattle Area Caucus, known as the New Crew, ran for office in the first widely contested elections in the lodge's history. They won several offices, managed to pass a motion in support of contract review at one lodge meeting. Meanwhile, in Wichita, Unionists for Democratic Change, running on a similar platform, won spots on the executive board of Local Lodge 834. Reformers also challenged another undemocratic practice, a rule designed to keep the union in the hands of incumbents. As in most local unions, attendance at union meetings was low. A bylaw requiring attendance at 6 of the previous 12 meetings in order to be eligible to run for the office disqualified 98% of the members of most lodges. In 1992, with the assistance of the Association for Union Democracy, insurgents complained to the Department of Labor that the rule had disqualified most candidates. Shortly before negotiations with Boeing began in 1995, the Department of Labor announced new regulations invalidating most uses of meeting attendance rules. Faced with the threat of a snowballing insurgency and without a meeting attendance rule to insulate them from challengers, the incumbents decided to adopt one of their opposition's most popular proposals, the three-day waiting period. The Boeing story shows how, even without control of the union, caucuses won a key reform that made possible a big labor victory. Now, going back to the, let's take on this this Teamsters at UPS example. Taking on Big Brown. The clearest example of union of four, a reform leading to union power, is the national UPS strike of August 1997. Although Teamsters are not a thoroughly rank-and-file run union, were not a thoroughly rank-and-file run union. 5 years earlier, members had bucked the union's hierarchy and elected a new reform leadership. Changes at the top of the union, combined with 20 years of education by TDU, the Teamsters for Democratic Union, made the difference between beating UPS and not taking on the company at all. TDU members at UPS had organized for years against productivity harassment and for including part-timers issues in union demands. Their discussion of working conditions over the years prepared UPSers to see through the company's rhetoric on 1997 bargaining. TDUers then became many of the key frontline warriors to organize the union campaign and strike, even where old guard leaders dragged their feet. The Teamsters contract campaign began in 1996. That year, the union surveyed UPS members about bargaining issues, reported the results, and announced contract goals based directly on survey responses. This contracted with the more usual practice of not setting specific goals for fear of raising members' expectations too high. The UAW bargaining convention, for example, passes a resolution every 3 years for a substantial wage increase. In announcing their goal of 10,000 new full-time jobs, union leaders showed that it would be up to the members later to decide whether any proposed agreement came close enough to that goal. The bargainers would not be able to say, well, really we were shooting for 1,000 new full-time jobs. Leaders did lower the goal from 15,000 jobs to 10,000 during pre-strike negotiations. In framing the issues, union leaders paired the full-time jobs question with the demand to stop contracting out. That way, all major sections of the workforce were involved in the struggle. Leaders trusted members to see the importance of the issues and to stay unified if the company offered something like pension improvements that benefited only full-timers. That trust was confirmed later when members stuck together on the picket lines, became the first spokespeople to local media on the strike issues. International officers were also clear they needed rank-and-file involvement to succeed. When local officers were slow to distribute campaign information or materials like buttons or whistles, the internationals sent them directly to rank-and-file activists. Again, top officials trusted the members they could not expect to control from Washington how materials were used. UPS management devotes considerable attention to winning workers' loyalty, and before 1992, the International Union had not challenged them in this arena at all. Management fully expected that within a week or so, Teamsters would start crossing the lines and the strike would be broken. But the months of preparation paid off, the strike was solid, and the victory was the biggest the labor movement had seen in many years. The victory was possible because so many UPS workers felt the struggle belonged to them. All right, back to the main text. A union that operates purely top-down may appear strong, or at least united, if members are willing to follow orders. But if members lose faith in their commanders and have no other way to make decisions or to exercise collective power, they'll end up acting as individuals instead. The results can be disastrous, members scabbing or engaging in militant but foolhardy individual acts, or most likely abandoning the cause. This is one of the reasons, not a justification, that there were members who scabbed during the UAW's strike at Caterpillar in the 1990s. Members weren't consulted on strategy at any point and had no collective way to turn around what looked like a losing operation. Confidence in leaders can come either from a history of those leaders winning regular gains or from the ongoing interchange between leaders and members that we call democracy. Since these days, significant improvements are near impossible to come by without a mobilized membership, unions at best rebuild democracy. When members get it wrong. One of the most demoralizing experiences for reformers is for members to vote against reform candidates or to reject referenda aimed at giving members greater rights. Why do members get it wrong and vote against their own rights and interests? The very powerful forces that unions must contend with, which operate inside the union as well as outside it, help explain why members sometimes expect to gain more power, better jobs or pay, more job security, by some method other than union democracy. The most powerful force a union faces is usually the employer. Management starts with power simply because of an economic and legal system that assumes management rights unless otherwise specified. Whatever the issues members are concerned about, it is the employer who gets to set the terms of the debate. It is management who decides whether the business will stay open or whether the agency will be privatized, what products will be made in what places, by whom, and with what processes. Even the union is in the position of reacting to management initiatives. Often the union is in the position of reacting to management initiatives. Management operates inside the union, too, by its power to divide workers by favoring one group or individual over another, whether it's through distribution of overtime or race discrimination, by offering better conditions and advancement to those who show their loyalty. Management can always find people willing to carry out its bidding in union affairs. Management also exercises its power directly on the union structure. It's common for management to let it be known which candidate for union office they'd prefer to work with. In other unions, it's traditional that the best route into management is to become a steward first. Or management can set up a system of thinly disguised but legal payoffs. Jointness, junkets, in the postal service it was employee involvement, junkets, and ease of getting overtime pay keep some officials addicted to their positions. Leaders can choose to base their power on the company's power rather than the rank and files. Union leaders offer a cooperative relationship with the company, helping to run the workplace and discipline the workforce. In exchange, the company offers its power to help union leaders keep their positions by rewarding friends, punishing enemies, occasionally making the officials look good. Looking to management and its allies for protection may seem to offer an easier, safer course than democratic unionism. In the case of SEIU Local 32B, 32J, which represents janitors, doormen, and elevator operators in New York City, the president of the local, Gus Bavona, makes multiple salaries totaling about $500,000, plus considerable expenses and perks. In 1997, reformers in the local called for a referendum on cutting officers' salaries. Bavona would have had to get by on $122,000 a year, and on electing rather than appointing the business agents who were supposed to handle daily representation duties. The reformers lost 55-45%. They needed two-thirds, but went to court because of election irregularities. The judge ordered a new election, noting that members had to mark ballots in view. Of union officials who were wearing vote no stickers. Whoa. Ballots were in English only. Many members speak only Spanish. And there was only one voting place in the city with limited hours, and the ballot carried a message from the leadership urging a no vote. The reformers welcomed the ruling, convinced that with a fair vote to be conducted by an outside agency, they would surely win. But when the vote was held in February 1998, Bavona won by 70%. To be sure, there were election irregularities, including an enormous amount of official campaigning on union time, but probably more important was Bavona's campaign. His machine created a climate of fear on both a general level, the union, jobs, and pensions will be destroyed, and on a personal level, support the reformers and your business agent may forget about you. The Bavona machine, by its own power and its close relationship with employers, was able to make such fears credible. If you spoke to Gus Bavona about this campaign, he would probably express a concept of unionism that justifies his pay and power. Members, too, adopt views on how unions work that become powerful supports for the status quo and barriers to democratic reform. We now turn to consider these conceptions. We'll look at different models of unionism, the belief in the powerful provider, and the smokescreen around democracy. But first, a little box on when members get it wrong. members vote to quote, let George do it, unquote. The June 1997 local union elections at the NUMMI plant in Fremont, California, show how members' view of business unionism can guide their actions. Business union-oriented administration caucus retook United Auto Workers Local 2244, top offices from reformers in the People's Caucus. In a key vote, former shop chair George Nano ousted People's Caucus leader Richard Aguilar from that position. The election had broad significance because the NUMMI plant had been the first and foremost model of lean production, team concept, and Japanese methods in the United States. Created as a joint venture of GM and Toyota and operated by Toyota, the plant regularly hosts delegations from workplaces around the world. Yet, a brief strike at the plant in 1994 and the company's many anti-worker policies gave the lie to many of the myths of labor management cooperation. Until shortly before the 1997 election, the People's Caucus had confidently expected victory. The local executive board, dominated by the administration caucus, was responsible for chaotic financial practices that finally resulted in trusteeship. Aguilar, on the other hand, had been an aggressive, hardworking shop chair, whereas grievances had been systematically discouraged under Nano in favor of joint problem solving. Aguilar set in motion training programs for all committee people of any caucus on how to pursue grievances. He was generally regarded as someone who was fair and put the membership first. Why did the People's Caucus lose the top spots? People's Caucus members and others have suggested a variety of reasons, some special to the circumstances. Some say the People's Caucus started its campaign late, overconfident, and poorly organized, but mainly the members were lured by the business model of unionism. Nano was able to appeal to the illusions that members often have about unions and politics alike. Leaders deliver the goods. If you don't like what you're getting, fire the bunch. Then go home and wait. Are you a new hire who doesn't like the two-tier negotiated in the last contract? Don't ask how you should organize to change it. Just vote for me. It was the membership's belief in this service model that allowed Nano to pin the blame for unpopular contract provisions on Aguilar, despite the fact that Aguilar had opposed them and was in the minority on the bargaining committee. The People's Caucus itself failed to counter the business union message. Many of their leaders thought they could use the same "we do it all for you" approach as Nano. It's not that People's Caucus members were against membership mobilization. It was never a part of their UAW training and consciousness. They underestimated the anger the members had with the day-to-day operations of the NUMMI system. It did not recognize that clean and fair grievance administration was not enough. Members wanted something done. Because the People's Caucus did not have the cooperation of either the UAW International or the company, the Good Service campaign just bolstered the administration caucus's claim that it could get more. They were the ones with connections to powerful people. The only power the People's Caucus had was its base in the membership. The more effective, though difficult, strategy would have been a campaign that emphasized membership initiative and actions. And here's another example. Looking for the powerful provider. The 1998 election for president of the Teamsters, where James Hoffa Jr. won 55% of the vote, is an example of the appeal of the powerful provider, the strong leader who will do it for the members. Invoking his father's name and using the slogan, "Restore the Power," Hoffa called up an image of the strong man pounding on the table and causing the bosses to shrink back in terror. TDU, on the other hand, when the group campaigned for reformer Tom Leadham, didn't promise immediate success against the employer's offensive. They reminded members that victory would require lots of hard work. A hafa offered easy results. Take one hafa, mix with union office, and get instant Teamster power. The members didn't have to do anything difficult, take chances, or use their own valuable time. All they had to do was mark the ballot for tough guy Jimmy. Given Hoffa's other advantages, including a mesmerized press, a huge campaign budget, and a three-year head start on the campaign, Hoffa ran and lost against Kerry in the overturned 1996 election. It's a victory for rank-and-file model of unionism that he won only 55% of the vote. Apparently, over the years, many members had come to learn that the way to power was not through blowhard leaders. Hoffa expounded again on his theory of union power after the UPS strike when he told the press, "You want a union with a lot of money in the bank and a strong leader. That's what gets employers' attention." Back to the main text. The business model of unionism. Most American unions, local and international, operate as though they were a business providing services to customers. The customers are the members and the employers. In this view, the union is the officers and the staff. They provide services for members, including grievance handling, contract bargaining, and various social services. That's why staffers often like titles like servicing rep or business agent. Paying dues to the union is like hiring a lawyer. The lawyer is the expert. You turn your case over to her. She tells you what to do and what your choices are. In the boom years after World War II, business model unions were able to deliver wage increases without much activity on the part of the rank and file. Nearly every contract contained substantial improvements. Management could pass on increased costs to consumers. They were ready to deal. But the basis for such deals fell apart in the 1970s. Competition from now rebuilt factories and other countries meant profits could be maintained only by reducing costs, including labor costs. Although recently some union officials have begun to discuss new strategies to deal with the vastly changed situation, most still rely on business union model, whose success ran out decades ago. The business model precludes democracy by denying knowledge to all but the experts. Members don't have the opportunity to learn about winning grievances, bargaining, or figuring out strategy. And the idea that they need servicing becomes self-fulfilling. As contracts become more and more complicated, the existence of experts is justified. The question of expertise is then used against any group of members that questions officials' strategy. A recurring theme in incumbents' campaign literature, for example, is the checklist on expertise, noting that the rank-and-file challengers have never bargained a contract, never prepared an arbitration case. Of course not. Only the officers are involved in those processes. The business model is not just the product of controlling union officials. It serves the interests of management, others who seek a compliant, business-like union. Instead of dealing with various, often angry rank-and-filers, management would rather deal with someone who dresses and talks much like themselves, someone who has far less at stake in a decision on working conditions, a business agent. Of course, the business model is described here as the best version where leaders actually do try to deliver. For the dues payers, worse is the no service model, where office holders see the union as means to enrich themselves, a barony to be handed down to sons and nephews. With high paying jobs at stake, these autocrats will use any tactics to retain their perks. They may use undemocratic rules to prevent members from running for office. They may ask management to fire members who speak out at union meetings or retaliate against them at the hiring hall. They may hire detectives to follow dissidents in such unions. The rank and file's tendency is towards cynicism and passivity. It's remarkable that some do form caucuses and run for offices under these circumstances. Most local unions are not this bad, of course, but even where leaders are not corrupt, where members do seem to have every opportunity to take control through honest elections, it's still not common for a sizable group of rank and filers to get together and say, let's take back our union and run it ourselves. Why? The business model has definite attractions. Who wouldn't prefer to have to leave the driving to us, as Greyhound used to advertise? Union members have demands on their time, from kids to church to overtime. Why go through all the headaches of meetings, debates, campaigning, all the frustrations of trying to convince others to be active, all the possible repercussions for management if the local president can deliver the goods instead? It's comforting to think that all you need for a strong union is a strong leader who can take care of you. Members thus can easily get stuck between a rational desire to be serviced and the frustration that comes when their hired leaders don't deliver, as happens more and more often. And if, finally, new leaders are elected who do want members to take responsibility, they are frustrated when members resist getting active. Our entire culture has taught them that it's the officer's job, not the members. Almost everything in our society teaches the message that we can't do it ourselves anyway. In particular, the relationship between the boss and the worker starts from the moment of hiring by establishing that the boss has the power and the worker has none, and the worker needs a job to live, the employer can pick and choose whom to hire. Much of the new technology and de-skilling of jobs leave the worker with less power than before. Advertising reinforces the idea that our only power in the world is to require more stuff, but we get to choose which brand. In the face of all these messages, it's no wonder that many union members don't even try to take back their unions. The organizing model. In the last few years, many union activists have talked about replacing the servicing model of unionism with the organizing model. Under this method of functioning, members are involved and active on their own behalf. For example, rather than a steward simply writing up a member's grievance, arguing it out with management behind closed doors, and reporting the results 6 months later, the organizing model would have him talk to lots of members about the issue and get them to sign on, making it a group grievance. If management is stubborn, they pull an action of some kind, such as all wearing stickers on the same day. If necessary, they escalate to actions that disrupt the workflow, like all visiting the boss's office together. They're in motion. They're organized. The organizing model is a big step forward from the servicing model, but it can have limitations. In practice, some union leaders can encourage member involvement without member control. They expect to turn member involvement on and off like a faucet. That way, leaders can keep tighter control of a possibly volatile situation. When the rank and file await their marching orders from clever staffers or officials, there's less likelihood they'll undertake tactics that step outside the conventional boundaries or threaten deals made elsewhere. An example was the mobilization, quote unquote, for the Detroit newspaper strike. In the strike's early days in September 1995, local leaders called a rally and march on the newspaper's printing plant. Members and supporters, feeling a sense of strength, decided to stay overnight at the plant gates to block scab trucks from exiting with the important Sunday edition. When the companies obtained an injunction against picketing, leaders quickly turned the mobilizing faucet off and ordered members away from the gates. They held no meetings to discuss this decision or even other tactics. Instead, they tried to turn members' energy toward a much tamer tactic, leafleting for a boycott of the newspaper's advertisers. Denied the opportunity to choose or even discuss strike strategy, members' participation dropped. Top-down mobilizing tends to be inflexible. To say, here are the steps, follow them. Now that various unions have involved members in contract campaigns, there tends to be a formula for how to carry them out. The steps are predetermined, and members are not involved in making decisions on when or how to act. If the manual says petition day comes before sticker day, that's the way it's got to be. Members are often enthusiastic when first involved to get involved first invited to get involved in organizing model type actions, but they may have their own ideas about effective tactics or timing. If they're not allowed some say in some in the new actions, they'll eventually vote with their feet. If enough members are turned off this way, the actions fail. In the long term, top-down mobilizing does not develop new leaders, nor is it the best way to get members to volunteer to organize new workplaces. How inspired can you be about your union if you have no say in it yourself? And there's a box here in the chapter. An organizing model that falls short. When unionists talk about discarding the servicing model of unionism and build an organizing model, sometimes the wires get crossed because organizing means two different things. For some, the organizing model means member mobilization. For others, the organizing model means that the union should change priorities to put resources into recruiting new members. A large percentage of the budget should go to the organizing department, and the staff's resources spent on servicing the already organized should be decreased. In the second sense, the organizing model is not enough. It's true that protecting working conditions for the already organized depends on spreading unionism. But the most effective organizing tool is a winning union, a union its members can brag about. As John Sweeney told the 1997 AFL-CIO convention, you could make 1 million house calls and run 1,000 television commercials and stage 100 strawberry rallies and still not come close to doing what the UPS strike did for organizing. After the 1997 UPS strike, more UPS workers than ever contacted the Teamster Organizing Department to volunteer for the drive at FedEx. The best organizers are empowered union members. That means bringing in new members has to be combined with winning better conditions for current ones. Another example is the organizing done by UAW Local 3000, based at a Mazda Ford joint venture in Flat Rock, Michigan. These assembly plant workers helped organize four smaller parts plants that supplied Mazda. The local recruited members to work on the campaigns and invited workers from targeted plants to union awareness classes. Mazda workers made home visits and leafleted the plants. Have no fear, we are 3,000 members strong, come join us. A week before one election, a 150-car caravan traveled 50 miles past the home of the plant manager on the way to a union rally. The Mazda workers joined in enthusiastically to recruit their lower-paid sisters and brothers because they had experienced power in their own local. Earlier, a reform slate had won office against officials who were management's partner in implementing lean production when the plant opened. Many local 3,000 members had never belonged to a union before, but after electing reformers, they organized an aggressive contract campaign and a spontaneous protest against an unfair attendance policy. The union was theirs, and they were glad to invite others to be part of it. Back to the main text. Enthusiasm for the union is also key to building solidarity beyond the membership. Potential supporters are mostly inspired by person-to-person contact and seeing that the people involved are active in making even greater sacrifices. But if the members of a striking union participate only as troops following marching orders, they're unlikely to inspire others. Their solidarity does not become infectious. Some of the best known labor solidarity efforts have depended on road warriors, rank-and-filers who took up their cause as a full-time job and traveled to spread the word about local P9 at Hormel, Pittston, the Staley Lockout, Ravenswood, the Diamond Walnut Strike. If democracy helps build member involvement, why not? Officials who want the ranks involved as troops often see rank-and-file leadership as a risk. Members may gain skills and confidence. They may demand even more say-so. Members who take initiative may run for office or in other ways get out of control. They may, for instance, organize a job action about working conditions the week after the union and management officials agree to a cooperative program. The case of the janitors of SEIU Local 399 in Los Angeles is an example of the faucet approach to mobilization. When SEIU staff were organizing these mostly Latino immigrant cleaners for union recognition, they conducted a whole range of militant actions. Janitors staged civil disobedience to disrupt business as usual in luxury office buildings and were beaten by the police. Finally, they won a union and a contract. Then they found themselves in a 25,000-member citywide SEIU local run very much in the old style. Suddenly, it was business as usual unionism. In response, the janitors joined with healthcare workers to organize a dissident slate called the Multiracial Alliance for the local's first contested election ever. They won every seat except the presidency, which they did not challenge. The old president refused to cooperate, and there was some tumult, and the SEIU's president, John Sweetie, threw the local into trusteeship. The local and the rank-and-filers had violated the understanding that their militant organizing was to stop when the staffers turned off the faucet. And here's another box. With the flick of the faucet. One sign of top-down mobilizing is quick about faces in basic strategy. SEIU's Justice for Janitors campaign in Washington, D.C. switched from militancy to cooperation with building owners with the writing of one open letter. Justice for Janitors campaigns have mobilized tens of thousands of building cleaners in various cities to demand union recognition. A partially successful 10-year campaign in Washington included sit-ins and blocking bridges. In early 1997, SEIU President Andy Stern decided to turn off the faucet. He sent a letter to building owners pledging to stop strikes, picketing, and similar activities in return for the hope that owners would pressure the contractors who directly employ the janitors. Before, the building owners were considered part of the management team that benefits from holding down pay and working conditions. Now, the union was proposing to the owners a partnership and saying to all those janitors who helped stage protests, you may now go home. There's nothing wrong with unions changing strategies, and union leaders should be able to make occasional quick, perhaps drastic, tactical shifts. But each time such a top-down shift is made, there's a cost to members' confidence in their leaders. If union officials have not already proven they'll seek full democratic decision-making whenever possible, or officials chart a course that most rank-and-filers would have opposed given the chance, the cost will be high. In the janitor's case, it seems unlikely that many of them changed their minds about the building owners in May 1997 just because Stern wrote his letter. We expect they'll be disheartened and less willing to participate the next time. Since the term organizing model can, back to the text, main text. Since the term organizing model can mean either a top-down version or a bottom-up one, we won't use the term in this book. When we want to talk about getting in the boss's face and members having the chance to shape whether, how, and when to do that, we'll talk about democracy and rank-and-file power. Our constant emphasis on the rank-and-file does not mean that we're against strong leaders. On the contrary, democracy makes leaders stronger. They look over their shoulder and they've got someone behind them. We're describing a healthy relationship between leaders and the ranks, not a way for the ranks to eliminate leadership. In fact, as we discuss in Chapter 2, the relationship between an empowered membership and a strong leadership is a central part of union democracy. Democracy and the new AFL-CIO. This is a whole section on this period when the book was written in the late 90s. Since 1995, the AFL-CIO has seen big changes in the top levels. The election of new energetic leaders was a boost to union's image. John Sweeney's New Voice team and thousands of lower-level officials, staff, and activists in various unions are calling for rebuilding labor by organizing the unorganized and making political action count. In many places, they're calling on members to get involved in these projects. What the New Voice team is not calling for, though, is a new, more democratic way of running our unions. A little mobilization. To their credit, the new AFL-CIO leaders encourage membership mobilization on several fronts. They encourage affiliates to train members as volunteer organizers. They envision street heat teams to carry out cross-union solidarity actions, and they propose a permanent base of at least 100 union activists in each congressional district to augment the work of paid lobbyists on Capitol Hill. But there's mobilization and there's mobilization. Without a big increase in democracy, the faucet model is the only way the labor movement can mobilize people. One sign of faucet style or mobilizing is large numbers of staffers with their hands on the tap. Both as president of the Service Employees International Union and at the AFL-CIO, Sweeney has dealt with just about any issue by hiring more staff. The 50 new state AFL-CIO directors, thus, plus four new regional directors and their assistants hired in 1996-97, are one example. Choosing sides. One of the big reasons for top-down mobilizing is a need to control where and when mobilization is to be used. Often, top-down mobilizers advocate militant tactics up to and including civil disobedience for organizing the unorganized. But such tactics are seldom encouraged when established unions confront management. This is because leaders of most international unions, along with the AFL-CIO union leadership, are committed to labor management cooperation. As Sweeney told the 1997 AFL-CIO convention, one of our paramount goals is to help the companies we work for succeed, to work with our employers to creatively increase productivity and quality, and to help American companies compete effectively in the new world economy and create new jobs and new wealth for our families and our communities to share. Under this win-win scenario, the union members benefit without cutting into profits. The problem, of course, is the companies continue to cut jobs, bust unions, contract out work, even when the union is thoroughly cooperative. They're searching for even more profits, and they're not planning to share. If you're a labor leader who believes in cooperation, though, you have only one criterion for deciding who's a bad employer to be mobilized against and a good employer who deserves cooperation. The employers who allow unions to exist in their facilities are the good ones. Only get militant toward employers that don't recognize the union. This charting of good employers and bad employers can get pretty confusing. Companies are often switched from one category to another without any noticeable change in workers' pay and conditions. That's why the cooperators and top-down mobilizers don't trust the membership to decide their own strategy. The question is too subtle to leave in the hands of anyone but top staff. The AFL-CIO's commitment to labor management cooperation and the good employer-bad employer distinction is illustrated by the partnership with Kaiser Permanente, a health maintenance organization. This arrangement was signed in 1997 by the Federation and affiliated unions, SEIU, AFSCME, and others that represent Kaiser workers. Under the agreement, Kaiser gets the AFL-CIO's commitment to aggressively market Kaiser to unions as a health plan. In late 1997, SEIU launched its I Choose Union Healthcare campaign as part of fulfilling this promise. What the unions get is recognition on the basis of a card check at any newly organized Kaiser facilities. Plus, union officials will sit on joint partnership committees for non-binding discussion of future changes in Kaiser's operations. The AFL-CIO initiated the partnership at a time when Kaiser was systematically cutting jobs, speeding up employees, demanding pay cuts, and planning to close facilities and contract out major operations. Kaiser workers have charged that quality of care is being hurt badly and federal investigators have cited serious deficiencies. But because the AFL-CIO unions are now bound to market Kaiser, they will have to keep their mouths shut about problems with the quality of care. They will lose any important weapon in their fight against these conditions, the possibility of drawing on public support. What unions gain is a chance to organize Kaiser workers without employer resistance. Kaiser joins the rank of good employers. Cooperation is a mistaken strategy, and it tends to distance union officials from the members, since those officials must always be sensitive to management's needs. In theory, members could choose cooperative strategies. Democracy doesn't guarantee good choices. In reality, though, most union members exposed to cooperation programs quickly find that management's actions speak louder than words. This was the Teamster slogan about UPS's team concept program in the months before the 1997 strike. Workers in partnership programs find the employer is still trying to squeeze more work out of fewer people, and they're understandably angry. When union officials are committed to cooperation, rank-and-file anger must be repressed to maintain good relations. Seldom are the ranks involved in deciding when and over what issues to end a joint program. Officials who favor cooperation believe the members would end it with little provocation, and they're probably right. That's why it's important to officials that they keep control of that decision. In many ways, the AFL-CIO's plans for revitalizing labor are very ambitious. In other ways, they continue the same old policies. But even the AFL-CIO's version of revitalization will not go far without democracy, without rank-and-filers organizing themselves. The massive scale of organizing now proposed, for example, can't happen under staff control, if only because of the numbers. Members must be out there telling their stories, sometimes acting on their own initiative, and members will have the stories to tell only if we increase union strength through democracy. The smokescreen around democracy and power. One of the reasons members don't take control of their unions is that they don't equate democracy with power. Why not? Partly because corrupt union leaders, even more so corporations, have an interest in maintaining a smokescreen around democracy and power. Members are led to see themselves as dependent on their elected officials, and to see democracy only as a question of mechanics. The confusion begins with what schools teach and the media reinforces. Ideas about power are not what we're taught in school. We're taught that democracy means simply the right to make a free choice between two candidates with no stuffing of the ballot box. Likewise, a union is said to be democratic if it has conventions, elections, votes on contract. But conventions usually act as rubber stamps for top officials. Elections may be organized to exclude most of the members as candidates, and contract votes are often taken without providing a true and thorough description of the terms. In other words, these forms and procedures don't guarantee rank-and-file power in the union. Certainly, conventions, elections, and contract votes are necessary steps, but democracy depends on an ongoing process of involving the ranks in knowing and grappling with the real issues facing the union, a process that is not automatic every time a member is handed a ballot. Holding a delegate election where candidates don't discuss the big choices facing the union, for example, is a smokescreen for backroom decisions on those choices. Another smokescreen is the confusing ideas we've been taught about power, that it means strongman individual power and power over others. School conditioned us to look at history in terms of getting great people making heroic actions. Didn't Lincoln free the slaves? Didn't Walter Reuther build the UAW? Didn't Ron Carey win the UPS strike? Even within the union, power is seen as power to a point. Power to punish your enemies, power of your machine. Thus, power becomes identified with intense personal competition. Perhaps because of this strong identity between power and personal competition, or because they've been on the receiving end of dictatorial power in the union, Some members try to give their leaders as little power as possible. In practice, this usually backfires. Formal, above the table power is replaced by backdoor and informal power, which is less accountable. The answer is not to try to abolish power, but to counter personal power with cooperative power. You will recognize the style of personal non-cooperative power shown below from the way corporations, armies, and other non-democratic institutions function. Unfortunately, this mode is also reflected in how powerful people act in non-democratic unions. Individually and as a group, we have more to gain from cooperating to build our power. Cooperative power functions differently. Two kinds of power. This is a chart, which I will try to explain verbally. One column shows union official controls others, and the other column shows members cooperate to wield power. Okay. Control over other people. Control over problems imposed by the external world. Control over information. Spread information widely. Keep people ignorant. Educate people. Pit people against each other. Identify common interests. One moves up at the expense of others. People move up by building others up. Member involvement is passive. They follow orders. Members actively involved. They contribute ideas and decide direction. Hierarchy controlled from top down. Hierarchy controlled from bottom up. Whoever has the most toys wins. Service, not wealth, is recognized. The power of cooperation is the true power of a union and the power of the rank and file within the union. This is the power that can explore Mars, create a precision basketball team, or make kids happy at a holiday party. It's the power that's potentially equal to the largest fortunes and the most destructive weapons. It's also the power that transforms the people who use it. This kind of power brings along with it a different set of personal values and ways that people organize themselves. It's not a new discovery. It's been a theme of solidarity unionism for more than a century. Democracy and cooperative power go hand in hand. Unless members do this work, the union can't succeed. Reform and the workplace. Again, the fundamental purpose of the union is power in the workplace. And since democracy and power are so intertwined, democracy also has to be rooted in the workplace. That's where it makes a difference. Thus, successful pro-democracy union reform efforts are essentially campaigns for workplace changes that the members need. If officials or bylaws get in the way, then they need to be changed. For example, a central organizing tool of the Teamsters for a Democratic Union is to organize members for contract demands. TDU started out as Teamsters for a Decent Contract. TDU activists often become known as the people who can help with a grievance if the businessman agent is ignoring it. When reformers take on workplace issues, officials may decide their methods are more effective and seek coalition with them. Or officials may try to protect their own positions at the expense of winning improvements from the company, thus revealing their own priorities. In any case, few members will work to change bylaws or elect new leaders unless they're convinced it will improve the way the union addresses their problems at work. Thus, whether we're talking about the elected leaders of a statewide local considering how to make a steward system work, or about a couple of coworkers at a kitchen table planning to get a steward replaced, their success or failure in building democracy will be measured in power on the job. That's the end of chapter 1.